Good afternoon. So last time we talked about kind of one of our most practical alternatives to overwriting return addresses, which we mentioned was kind of our first relatively generic way of using a buffer overflow to make a program do what we wanted. And this was to find other function pointers and a big source of other function pointers where these vtables, which were used to implement polymorphism in something like C++. So we had this pointer at the beginning of our objects that gave a table of the actual implementations of the methods for the objects, the idea being that if we had a pointer to a shape and we didn't know if it was a circle or a square, that table would tell us where to find the methods for whatever subclass it actually was. And when we had a buffer overflow that overwrote part of one of these objects, we could replace that vtable pointer with something. And generally the idea would be that we replace it with something that could be interpreted as a new vtable pointer, meaning that it should point to some data that has more pointers to functions, because that's what the normal vtable would have. The normal vtable would say, oh, this is the circle draw method and the circle area method, and our modified vtable that we pointed to, our new fake vtable would have, this is the draw method, which is actually not a pointer to our shellcode. This is the area method, which is actually a pointer to our shellcode, and that sort of thing. And we also talked about more about thinking about overwrites where we don't overwrite an actual sort of target value, but we overwrite another pointer that lets us do some different write selection. What we're calling pointer subterfuge is a name that's sometimes used in literature. And kind of this lets us chain one write that's an overwrite into writing somewhere else. We saw an example of this with the NTBD exploit. We kind of gave a brief overview that we had this overflow in the global variable region. And there wasn't any obvious pointers to functions there, but that wasn't a problem because there was a pointer to data, in fact, the pointer for the buffer that this code was writing. So we first replaced that pointer and then ran that code again with the modified pointer, and this time it wrote to a location of our choice. And we could choose that location to be one of these function pointers we could target. And in the example, in the exploit, they chose the global offset table. And another thing we talked about in looking at that proof of concept is something that we're going to come up sort of much more later, which is that rather than writing shellcode, which is kind of the most straightforward way of executing arbitrary code, we can just point to existing code. And in the case in the exploit, they have this really easy solution, which is that the C library has a function which runs a command, and they could replace that function with stringlen, and so that function would be called with whatever stringlen was called with, and stringlen, not surprisingly, was called with something related to input the attacker could control, so this let them run kind of whatever command they liked. And this idea of kind of reusing existing code in the executable is something we're going to talk about more in a topic we'll talk about probably mostly next week, of return-oriented programming, that we're going to see a much more flexible and sophisticated version of this where we don't need to rely on having a very convenient function like system, even though often we would. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so if you didn't notice, the assignment due on Friday is sort of stack smashing. I am surprised I haven't gotten much questions about it in office hours, because it is usually something people have more questions about. I'm not here after today. My TAs should be able to help, but fine. And I guess I would say the quiz that was due Monday was very deliberately kind of going through the steps you'll need to do in the assignment to hopefully make that more familiar. But questions on the assignment? Yes. Okay, so you're saying you're trying to disable ASLR. So you should be able to use the setarg command regardless of whether you're getting any error messages on login about modules. That is a separate, independent issue. As for getting error messages about modules, this is in a your home directory .bashrc. There's a dot here. And dot files will not normally appear in LS, so if you're looking with LS without the dash A option, you won't see it. You need dash A to see files that begin with a dot. So it's probably there, you just didn't notice it because LS doesn't list those files by default. But that shouldn't affect whether the setarg command, which we're using to disable ASLR, actually works. That should be completely unrelated. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Other questions? But yes, good on logistics of setarg. Yeah, and it's the bashrc, but those module load errors are mostly harmless. But yeah, it's good to modify your bashrc to remove stuff that basically doesn't work with the current module system, but did work when you took CSO1, when you ran a script that added things to your bashrc that you probably don't remember. Other questions on the assignment? Okay. So at the end of the last time, we briefly went over kind of this example of our using a pointer to write a pointer. So we'll look at this in. And in this example, we have some S that we can first set this email field. And the layout of this struct we're assuming is basically that we have email, and then we have assignments, which is an array of pointers. And initially, this is going to point to a real assignment that has the submission file and then the read-grade request field. And we'll assume, and if you look up how this compiler actually compiles this, that these are like laid out right next to each other in the struct. And so our question is, how do we set string 1 and string 2 to overwrite a particular memory address with a particular value? And our goal is that we're going to want this to become the memory address. We're not going to want it to become a memory address, we're going to want it to become something related to the memory address. But what we actually want is that this memory address plus 128, we want that to be the memory address. Because what we want to happen is we want, when we're writing our fake read-grade request, we want that to be located at that particular address. So we're actually going to work backwards, that we want this address to be the 10203040 50, which means that this address is, I'll call that address a star, is going to be star minus 128, which means that that's what we want to put in assignments of 0. And assignments of 0 is the same thing as email of 128. So our string 1 is going to have this address, which is the original address minus 128, stored as the bytes we'd expect in a pointer this far into the buffer. So, and then we have some stuff beforehand, which doesn't matter as long as string copy will copy it. And then for string 2, well, string 2 is going to be string copied into that read request field. So in there, we're going to actually put our value we want to write to that memory address. Questions? This kind of two-step overwrite. So this style of thing is what next week's homework is on. I want to be careful that we understand it. Also, figuring out these situations with multiple steps, this is kind of, going to be related to what we see with return-oriented programming, where we have we're setting up a series of events to happen. That's frequently what sort of modern exploits need to be, because as we'll see, just running shellcode is not so easy. Other questions? Okay, so next we're going to talk a bit about ways to prevent exploits, and we're talking about two issues. One is going to be about memory protection, sort of protecting memory from reading, writing, and execution. And the other is going to be about ASLR, address randomization. So we'll start with memory protection. And if you've taken CS02, you've seen this slide of mine, that kind of the way our memory works is that we have some addresses our program uses that we call virtual addresses, and the OS actually specifies how those addresses map to the machine. And in particular, they specify this on a granularity of pages. And on the systems we're going to use, pages are 4,096 bytes, which means that the OS basically fills in this giant table, which is going to be stored a little more efficiently than the slide suggests, saying that each of these ranges of addresses has a corresponding range of real addresses. And also in this table, the OS can specify whether it's readable, writable, or as we'll talk about later, executable. And the processor will use this table when it executes programs. And if the program tries to access some range that isn't marked as readable or writable when it's reading or writing, the processor will tell the OS, hey, something's going on here, what do you want to do? And this is how we would have the OS be able to trigger something like a setbolt. Questions about this very, very brief overview that I need to do, because some people here haven't taken CS02. I'm trying to make sure those people aren't lost. So please, three questions. So this is set by the OS. So when our program runs, we're not using the real memory addresses. We're using these mappings set by the OS, which has these permission bits, which are important. So this idea is called virtual memory. And something you'll note that this lets us do is, one thing is, lets us set memory to be inaccessible, to trigger a segfault. And if we can do this, one question might be, why do buffer overflows not just always trigger segfaults? Couldn't we make that happen? And this is something that sometimes, actually is done. So for example, let's say I want to do this for memory I allocate with malloc or new. I can set up the memory when implementing malloc or operator new in C++, such that we have what's called a guard page after and before our allocation. And what I mean by that is that in my mapping of the OS, we have this address range here corresponds to some address and is readable and writable. Or I should draw this diagram correctly, sorry. This address range here corresponds to some address range, is readable, writable. This address range is also readable and writable, and corresponds to a different address range. But the addresses kind of above and below here, this is not readable, not writable, and this is not readable, not writable. So if we can ask the OS to set up the mapping in the right way, we can make it so this dynamically allocated buffer, if we overflow it by going past the end, we get a segfault. And if we arrange our buffer such that it ends on one of these page boundaries, so it's kind of the edge of that one entry in that mapping, we can make it so even if you go one byte over, it set faults every time. And it sure seems like it would be nice if, like, all our buffers were set up this way. It would make it a lot harder to do buffer overflow attacks. Like, probably not impossible. We talked about, like, cases where we, like, skipped over a canary because there was weird array indexing. So we miss some cases, but most of the time our buffer overflows are this sort of thing where we want to go right after the buffer, or potentially right before the buffer, which also wouldn't work in this case. Wouldn't set fault consistently, but if we kept going, we're not going to hit anything useful. So, can we do this idea? And I'll say as a preview that for large memory allocations, almost every implementation of malloc does this, but only for large memory allocations. So if you allocate a huge array, probably it has these guard pages allocated with it. If you allocate a small one, it usually doesn't. And the big reason why it usually doesn't is that we have these 4 kilobyte units that the hardware lets us specify the mapping in. And that means we're wasting space. And in this example, we're wasting kind of this space here. So we have a pretty big space overhead. So this is something we can do. It's done for large allocations, but for small allocations, it's usually not done. And that's because we have to allocate in these 4K units, so we have to round up to the next 4 kilobytes. And if we're allocating a megabyte, that's not a big deal. If we're allocating 1,000 bytes, that's a very big deal. The other thing is that this is substantially slower. So most fast implementations of malloc try to allocate a whole bunch of memory from the OS and parcel it up in chunks. And that's because making the request to the OS is relatively expensive. With this strategy, we need to make a request to the OS because we can't edit this mapping here ourselves. So we can't insert the not readable stuff ourselves. We have to ask the OS for help with that. And that process has kind of a minimum cost to communicate with the OS. Also some additional cost if our program is multi-threaded, then the OS needs to tell the other cores that, hey, the mapping got changed for the program that's currently running. Make sure you know about it. So, you know, it's also substantially more expensive. There have been implementations of malloc that do this all the time. Probably the most notable is something called Electric Fence, which is probably not popular these days because it was basically trying to do what you might be more familiar with Address Sanitizer from CSL1. Trying to do the same thing in the early 90s, but use this strategy. But, you know, in that case, it was a debugging tool. It was okay to waste a lot of space and be slower. This is not something most people would find okay to do for a kind of production program. Okay, so we have this guard page idea. So it has some overhead, but you might say, okay, well, at least we can do this for all big buffers. And there's some other problems. So one other problem is things like structs. That the C compiler expects the buffer to be followed by the pointer after a few bytes. Or maybe directly, it depends on the rounding works. But basically expects this buffer to be immediately followed by the pointer. It would be very reasonable to say we should add a guard page after this buffer, but to do that, we need to tell the C compiler, hey, this struct has a 4,096 byte hole between the buffer and the pointer. Take that into account when you're writing your assembly that accesses pointer. And that's probably not something we can do unless we recompile all the code that uses this struct. And quite problematically, quite often we have some sort of buffer in a struct where we would like to protect that buffer from overflow, but we can't really. And we also have the same problem with arrays. If we have an array of things which have a buffer in them, array of structs, for example, the C compiler expects the array elements to be right after each other. If we want to change that, we have to recompile all the code that uses that array. So guard pages are very, kind of don't solve this problem, and this is unfortunately a relatively large portion of buffer overflows. So I said guard pages are wasteful, so let's think about how wasteful. So let's say we want to prevent overflows of stuff on the heap. How much extra space will we waste? Doing adding guard pages for this set of allocations. I'll take an approximation. Now we'll just start with the first item, simplest to compute. Let me do some options. So we'll say less than 5%, 10, 20 through 30. 30 to 50, and that's more than 50. So let's figure out which of these buckets. Less than 5% overhead, so 105% of the normal space, 105 to 110, 5 or 10%, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, 30 to 50, more than 50. So for our larger than 4K. So who wants more time to make an estimate with that kind of precision? Okay, that's what I want to figure out. Where are we in here, right? Is it less than 5% extra space we're wasting? Is it more than 50% more space? How bad is it for this program? If we had guard pages for all these, 10,000 byte objects, just make sure that those can't be overflowed by having a page that's accessible right after them. That will trigger a seg fault every time. question?
They don't actually do this, right?
They don't actually do. So real malloc implementations do add guard pages. They probably have a higher threshold for the minimum size to which they add guard pages than definitely higher than one page. But there's some threshold above which they will add guard pages for most malloc implementations.
That's good, because my next question was about to be, how do I disable them?
And when we see the number, we'll maybe have some opinions about what that threshold should be. Okay, so who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, it's less than 5%? B, it's 5 to 10? C, 10 to 20? D, 20 to 30, a few heads. E, 30 to 50, okay. F, over 50, okay. So with this program, our allocations over 10,000 bytes. So if we were just allocating like 5,000 byte objects, yeah, we'd have well over 50% overhead. In this program, we're not doing that. It's about 10,000 bytes. So to make this work, we're going to round up to the next multiple of 4096 for what we actually allocate. And we're going to end up having our 10,000 bytes stored with 12K, and we have some unused space before it. And then we have these inaccessible regions. And I guess something else you want to be thinking is those inaccessible regions, they have to have allocated memory. We don't have to do that. Since they're not accessible, we don't need to actually have any real memory backing them. So we won't consider them space overhead. If you did, you'd definitely get above 50%. But I don't include those because in practice, we'll point them to nowhere because they're inaccessible. It doesn't matter when our OS sets up that map. And so I end up with an extra 2,000-ish bytes for every allocation. Which is about 22% overhead. So in this example, we're in class D. Question, yes?
So for every allocation, you would need to add 3 or 4 pages?
So for every allocation of 10,000 bytes, that does need 3 pages, but usually we can use the rest of one of those pages for like the next allocation. With this scheme, we have to reserve the whole of those 3 pages for that 10,000 byte allocation, so we have 2,000 bytes which are unused in order to make it so that before or after that allocation isn't something else, right? That there's nothing between it and the guard pages. So that's kind of our wasted space.
The guard pages themselves
aren't wasted space because we have to have those entries in the table anyways, and we don't have to point them to valid memory. They're not quite not wasted space because those table entries do take up space in net, but that's a pretty minor cost. And if we do a similar calculation for other allocations, things get a lot worse. So for a 1,000 byte allocation, we need to allocate a whole page, because otherwise, because if we use the rest of the page for some other allocation, something can overflow into the other one, which would defeat the point of this idea. So we're going to waste. So in that case, we have well over 50% overhead. We have, it would take 3 times the space. And this is why people did not run by electric fence was a debugging tool and not a production tool. So in practice, usually there's most malloc implementations do this guard page thing, but they usually have a threshold in like the hundreds of kilobytes kind of range for when they do it. And they're doing it less as a security thing and more as a debugging thing. It just catches bugs to add guard pages. And often maybe you'll add extra guard pages in case, like if you have a big array, you index it wrong and go way over. You might try to add more than one guard page just as a debugging tool. Not because it's going to solve a security problem, though it might by accident, but because people like it when their code crashes more often when they make mistakes rather than doing something weird. Okay, so far I've just talked about guard pages on the heap. And that's because kind of the history of this idea is that it's usually done on the heap because in that case, we as a programmer can choose what code we use to set up that memory. When we're thinking about the stack or the initial stuff that's loaded for our programs, we typically don't write that code. We write in the compiler or the standard C library to write that code, and it's hard to swap it out for something else compared to using a new version of malloc. You just call a different function other than malloc, now you can have an allocator which does something different. But it's not so easy to call a different function and have your main be set up differently. So you could potentially add guard pages like between big global variables. That might be a good idea. I don't know anyone who does it. But it's viable. You can represent that. You could potentially add them to arrays on the stack. I don't know anyone who does this. The former would require sort of linker and compiler support, so you'd like need to set up the program to have multiple segments. So basically you have a load directive for the array, then a gap, then a load directive for something else. But I don't know any linker or compiler combination that does that, even though you could. And for the stack, you need to add like calls to request that the system make some memory inaccessible and modify the compiler to generate that code, which is doable, but seems a lot more work to do. Yeah?
Like, stack theories kind of do this,
So the question is, stack canaries do this, but you can kind of skip those. So you can still skip over these, you just have to skip over 4k. But you can't like find out their value, right? Like a stack canary. There's no value to find out. So yes, you're right that this like stack canaries kind of serve a very similar purpose. And this is just and you can kind of think of doing this on the stack as similar to what stack canaries do. I guess the other big difference is that if you're acting on guard page arrays on the stack, that we'd be protecting anything after the array from an overwrite, not just a return address, you know, because remember stack canaries only really protect the return address, and we detect the overwrite immediately, not when we return. Your question?
I was wondering if it's possible to set up
guard pages
manually.
Is it possible to set up guard pages manually? Yes. So on Linux, the way you do this is either mprotect or mmap calls can do that.
And that would just set up so you could allocate the space.
So you can allocate space, make sure the pages around it are inaccessible? Yeah. So mprotect changes the permissions on part of your memory, and mmap maps something to the memory, and you can use either to specify, I'd like this memory region to be not readable or writable. Or executable. And this is the sort of thing that those implementations of malloc that set up guard pages could be doing. It's one way of doing it. Other questions? So we talked about this kind of comparing the stack canary. So we could imagine kind of using this as a stack canary replacement. The big problem is that, you know, we have to do this kind of at a multiple of 4096, so we're going to have a bunch of wasted space, and we have to make calls to the system, to the operating system, to set this up, to make the changes to the table. We could imagine doing it, and this has the advantage over stack canaries that information leaks won't help you defeat this. But you know, any attempt to write to this guard page will trigger a seg fault immediately. It's not like stack canaries where if you know what value to write from an information leak, you just write it. But I don't expect anyone to do this because this space overhead and time overhead is pretty substantial. So space overhead from that, to make this happen, I need to kind of round things so this work, the rounding works out, so the buffer is right against the guard page, which means that in practice, the way this might look is we have our return address, then we have a bunch of unused space, then we have a guard page, and then we have our buffer. And that unused space could be pretty disappointing. And also that unsetting up this guard page is way more expensive than returning from a function. I would probably estimate like 100 to 1,000 times more expensive. So probably not something you will be happy doing. Kind of another idea you might have is that instead of setting up an explicit like guard page, we could temporarily mark part of the stack as read-only. And we can make it so the return address is contained in that region of stack. This still involves wasting about the same amount of space, but we assign fewer table entries. This is the same idea, but chain effect, right? Here, we aren't hiding where the stack return address is. There's no secret values. It's just that, until we flip this bit writable back to readable, this writable bit back, any attempt to overflow the buffer is going to trigger a seg fault because you can't write to the region of memory that contains the return address. So this is, again, something people don't do because the overhead is way too high and it would require modifying the compiler, but this kind of gives us an idea of what's possible with the tools the operating system has. So that gets us into kind of the idea of marking memory as read-only. And we've kind of already mentioned this issue when I said, if we have this pointer subterfuge idea, we can write to an arbitrary place in memory. And I mentioned, we could try to overwrite the machine code and kind of immediately dismiss that option because, of course, that would not be possible. But the reason why it's not possible is because the compiler's actually gone through some effort to make coding constants be able to be marked as not writable. Because if you think of it, when we load a program, we expect some of the stuff that's loaded to be modified. Like we have like the initial values of global variables and things like that. Those we expect to be modified. There's some other stuff we don't expect to be modified. So how does the compiler make that happen? And I think you've seen .data and .text in CS01. So in our assembly, we mark kind of what's in, we mark our assembly as being in different sections. And so for example here, I have some global variables, and I have two different global variables. One is a pointer to the constant hello, and the other is a mutable array of characters which initially contains hello. And so my pointer points to a constant. And my compiler is smart enough to generate assembly code which will put that constant in a separate region of memory so we can mark that region of memory as read-only, even though we don't want to mark the region of memory for bar as read-only, because we can actually modify all the elements of the bar array. And how the compiler does this is it marks dot bar as being in the data segment, and the pointer foo is in the data segment, but the string that foo initially points to is in this segment which is opaquely named on Linux, rodata.string1.1. And we have some other annotations here telling the linker that this region contains strings and is data for the linker to use later. Questions? is settled. And by doing that, we enable the linker to produce what we've seen in binaries we've seen, where we have something that's loaded as read-only and something that's loaded as read-write. Questions? And so to make that happen, the compiler did this first step of when it writes assembly, it needs to carefully separate our mutable data from our read-only data and our code into separate sections so the linker can separate them when it's producing an executable or library. And we also need to have the linker add padding between these sections because we know we can only mark these 4 kilobyte regions as read-only, and we can actually see that here in that, you know, this here, we have some extra space between these two regions, which is padding to allow us to have the second region be marked as read-only. It can't be right up against the other one. We need to have it rounded up to a 4K multiple at some point. And usually the way this works internally is that linkers take something called a linker script, which most importantly is kind of a list of here are the sections, here's the order you put them in, here's where you add padding. So the compiler writes that for the linker saying, I want you to put the text, then the data, and I want you to make that into a read-only load segment. Then I want you to pad up to the next power multiple of 4K. Then I want you to put the read-only data, you know, the compiler writes this file which kind of gives this specification for how does the linker produce an executable from the sections it has. Okay, some questions? So this idea lets us put kind of things like code and constants in unmodifiable memory. But this doesn't solve our problem, and we've seen examples of that, of things we can't mark real. So some of these, we're not gonna have a good solution to. Like the return address on the stack, we can do it, but it has this huge overhead to mark that as read-only. Function pointers kind of in local variables, like directly or indirectly through vtables. Really tricky to figure out how to make that happen, make those read-only, because like they're part of the local variable we expect to be modified. We had kind of two other things that we would like to be unmodifiable, which seem trickier. And the reason these seem trickier is that our global offset table and our table of vtable pointers, these have to be set up when we load our program. And for the global offset table, it has to be when we load our program because we have to figure out, well, there's an entry for string len. I need to find out where is string len in the library I'm loading. And we don't know that when we compile the executable. So that means we have to load something and then modify the global offset table. That's the normal operation. And for our table of function pointers, this is a little less obvious. But if the function's in a library for the base class, we have to fill that in at runtime. Or if we're loading at a dynamically chosen address, we need to fill in those addresses at runtime. So we can't just mark the vtable's initial values or the global offset table as read-only when the program loads. We can't set it up by fixing, you know, by setting something here to not writable. That's just not going to work because we need to write them normally. So questions about that idea? So if we just set it read-only, the loading code's going to break. So there's an idea to fix this problem called relocation read-only. And this is a change to how the dynamic linker works. So the dynamic linker is going to fill in the global offset table and fill in those vtable pointers based on where the program's actually loaded. And there's an option to opt in to telling the linker that when you're done filling that in, mark that memory as read-only. And this appears as a program header entry in our ELF program. So you might have seen this entry here labeled RELRO, and that's telling the linker that, hey, when you're done setting up this program, doing the linking, mark this region of memory as read-only. There's also a related option, which is that in order for the linker to be done filling in the global offset table, we can't do that lazy binding we talked about at the beginning of the semester. So at the beginning of the semester, we mentioned, oh, sometimes we might fill in that global offset table as functions are called. So loading the program is faster. If we have, like, 1,000 global offset table entries, we only call, like, 100 of them in our execution of the program, we'll just save the work of filling in the other 900 if the user didn't request those features. But we can disable that, and if you're using GCC or Clang, you can use these options when linking to turn on and off these features. RELRO is for most things on by default for the past, like, 8 years or so. Yeah?
So, am I correct in assuming that the main reason you wouldn't want to do this is in case, like, you want to change the entries while you're running the program or while something else is running? Like, you're maybe changing references.
So the question is, why wouldn't you want to do this? So the Z now, because there's an actual performance cost. For the RELRO, I think the reason why it's not default is there's the concern that some programs may change these deliberately, and you don't want to break those programs. And like, there's examples of why you might try to change it deliberately. So like, if you want to do interesting debugging of libraries, changing the global offset table is a nice way to write a debugger that like sees what library calls are being made and things like that. Or you might have other things like that your program's doing to like fix up, to like load libraries in a funny way. So I assume that's why they didn't just like turn it on retroactively for programs, why it's specified in the program header. And probably the other reason is that for this to be useful, we need to have the global offset table be in a separate page so we can mark one thing in the table as read-only and not break anything else. And that's probably the other reason why. So probably some old programs have the global offset table next to stuff that has to be writable. And if you did that, oops, we can't use this feature. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay, your question? No? Okay. Thought I saw some other hands. Okay. Okay, so in my last minute, we'll talk about the other permission bits I didn't talk about, which is executability. If we can set memory not writable, we can set it not executable, right? And the answer these days is yes, you can do that. And there's lots of names for doing this. And we're going to talk about as our next topic about how we can still do all the exploits we talked about even with this feature turned on. The reason why this is new is that historically, processors didn't actually support marking memory as non-executable. Like, it wasn't a thing until 64-bit x86, or for 32-bit x86 until about 2000. Like, it wasn't supported in processors. And also, there's a bunch of ways programs like did things which depended on things like the stack being writable. Which they had to get out of software. But yes, this is a thing we do today, and kind of our next exploit-related topic will be about, you know, how do we work around this? We've seen a preview of that with ARC injection, the return to system idea, and we'll see sort of a more sophisticated version of that. So, as I mentioned last time, I am leaving the state, so Brad Campbell should cover a lecture on Friday, and he'll possibly finish up talking about write X or execute and then talk about ASLR and maybe start on that sort of more advanced exploit technique if there's time. That's where I'll finish up today.